I'm Julie Epps, representing Mr. Bonds. I'd like to start out with...
Ms. Epps, could you move the... Thank you.
Nobody can ever hear me, even with the microphone.
I have the opposite problem. People can always hear me.
That might be good or bad, depending. I was just telling
you. Your question if you can't be heard, so.
I'm sure you'll ask me to clarify if you can't hear me. I was just telling Mr. Cleveland that it's bad enough that we have to humiliate ourselves in front of the court. We have critics back here, too.
I think it's an educational exercise. So.
Well, we then discovered that apparently we're going to have critics in Oxford next month for an argument that have as well. I'm going to start out with the search issue because that's the most factually complicated. And I know you all have read the briefs and are probably better at it than I am, but I'm going to start off with what the trial judge found with regard to the search, and that is that he found there was a good faith basis for the officers to believe that the warrant was valid. And he based that on a finding that there were allegations of a continuing pattern of illegal activity over the course of some several years from about 2003 through 2009. And on the fact that the affiant, Randy Walsh of ICE, had said that drug dealers frequently keep records, et cetera, at their houses. And so the judge reasoned that because agents had gone by a Biloxi Street building in Jackson, Mississippi, which is where Bonds had a place of business, he had two businesses registered in the tax records to that address, one an auto sales business and another a trucking business. And what the officer said in the affidavit was that surveillance showed two businesses there, an accounting business and a hairdressing business. The judge inferred from that there was no auto business there, and therefore the only place that Bonds could have been storing marijuana would have been at his house.
Okay, you can see that you are arguing the third exception to, you know, good faith, that the warrant was based on an affidavit so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render official belief in its existence entirely unreasonable.
Correct. I mean,
that's a pretty tough standard.
It is. But the problem here with this affidavit is it's pretty well crafted. It's very detailed in allegations that the agents received from informants, but none of the informants were there's no reason for crediting what they said. They were first-time informants. They were all trying to get themselves off.
But is it entirely unreasonable to rely on what those informants, for the officer to accept that the magistrate could have relied upon that?
Well, I think so, because what you've got to do is you've got to get into the house. You've got to show not just that he was a drug dealer, but that it was more likely than not that drugs were at the house. And the problem is that there's no timely nexus to
it's just probable cause.
Well, but you still have to have a timely nexus to the house.
But it's not a really high burden on a warrant as it is in, say, convicting someone in a criminal case.
Well, it is still more probably than not. And what you have here, the only
probable
thing...
Probable cause.
I'm sorry?
Probable cause.
Right. Mm-hmm. The only thing you have here that ever connects any drug dealing with the house is a statement by Todd Waters that sometime prior to June of 2008, he had seen drugs and currency at the house. Now, there's no specific date other than prior to 2008. We can assume that Waters acquired his information sometime between 2006 and 2008 because there is a statement by another informant that he introduced Waters to Bond sometime between 2006 and 2008. So we've got a real indefinite time period, but we also have other places where the drugs could have been. In addition to saying that he had seen drugs at the Biloxi Street house, Waters said he saw them at a building owned by Bonds on Lynch Street. Bonds also owned a trucking company with plenty of big rigs. He lived at another house in Jackson with his girlfriend. And so when you get down to what ties the drugs to this particular place, the evidence is pretty lacking. And so to me, that's what the issue is whether or not there's a nexus to this particular place as opposed to many of the other places.
Let me direct your attention to the issue of staleness. That seems to me to be, strikes me as the strongest of your arguments. As I read this record, there's some 1.5 months lapse between the, quote, pattern of activity and the actual use of the warrant to make the entry. So this means that you have to leave a probable cause to believe that they were searching for drugs, not records. Drugs are consumable, so that's a 1.5. The inference has to be drawn is that 1.5 months later, that there's probable cause to believe that drugs are in the situs. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is that correct time?
The way I understand the timeline. Excuse me, I'm suffering from a cough that won't go away, and I don't want to start. As I understand the timeline, the last real thing that ties him at all to any continuing activity is a statement by an informant, Denman, who was transporting some drugs to Jackson back in October of 2008.
The CS1 report, June 15th, is what the record shows.
I'm sorry, June 15th. Let me look at CS1 here again.
Well, you don't need to go search that out.
I'm not sure.
Correct, because I'm reading from it, so.
Are you reading? He was indicted, I think, in June of. Anyway, you're looking at it.
My question is a friendly question. It is. I'm just trying to be clear that. My understanding that it is correct that there's a 1.5 month lapse between the time of this quote pattern of activity and so forth. And whether that's reasonable and anticipatable is another question, and the government will respond to that. But I wanted to be sure everybody's on the same page about the time lapse because I thought there was some confusion about that. You're not sure it is 1.5 months, or am I correct?
I'm suggesting it was further than 1.5 months away. If you're looking at a particular passage, then obviously you're correct. But the last thing that I had noted was...
Just cut to the chase. What do you contend is the time lapse?
I contend that last one was the Denman... transaction where Denman was supposed to be bringing some drugs to Jackson in October of 08. And the most that connects Bonds to that is that Denman said that he and Burns were transporting the drugs and that Burns was communicating with Bonds, who was supposedly in Phoenix, and that's the, he doesn't say communicating about drugs, he just says communicating.
Well, the affidavit reads as follows. CS number one continually informed, that's confidential, continually informed, quote, one of two Phoenix DEA agents, each time that Darryl Bonds and Cedric Burns are present in Phoenix, Arizona. After notification, Burns and Bonds' presence has been collaborated, I think they mean corroborated, by surveillance and other investigative techniques. The last notification by CS number one occurred on or about June 15, 2009. A client believes the aforementioned pattern of activity is ongoing. That's the date they used.
That's the date that he was in Phoenix, but there's no surveillance or no anything else that indicates any particular drug activity, and you have to remember
But the only evidence implicating Bond in that pattern appears to be this CS number one report on June the 15th. That's 1.5 months before the warrant issued.
Correct. That was showing that he was in Phoenix. But it does. What my point is that it doesn't connect him with any illegal activity.
Some point in time, these warrants become stale. You can't get a warrant and put it in your pocket and get around to using it down and pull it when you need it.
Correct. There has to be a timely nexus to the house.
What's your best case that this is untimely?
The case law, I've cited several cases in there. None of them are exactly on point because you have to determine it really on an ad hoc basis as to what kind of items we're searching for here.
Well, they were searching for records, not just drugs. I mean, there's a long list of records they're looking for.
They were searching for records, but of course they didn't find any.
Okay, but the search warrant sought not just drugs, but records of illegal activity, and that bears upon the overall analysis. Right?
But again, there has to be a timely nexus.
No, I don't think anybody denies the timely that there needs to be one. I'm just saying that the scope of the search was not simply consumable drugs, but also records.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to address the sentencing issues at all, either one? Let me just ask you this. I was a little bit confused about the idea that conduct in other states could not be relevant conduct for sentencing purposes.
Oh, I think it can be.
Okay, and the judge, though, seemed to be saying not that this didn't happen in these other states, not that it was disconnected from what he was doing, but that it ought to be charged in these other states and not part of relevant conduct here. And isn't that an error of law?
It would be an error of law, except that he is allowed to reject that as a basis for sentencing if he chooses to. I think what the problem here is that what he actually said with regard to whether or not he accepted those statements as true, he said there was a lot of evidence in the record, meaning I think the warrant, but not at the trial about that.
But that doesn't make any difference. They don't have to present the evidence for purposes of determining relevant conduct for sentencing. They can present the evidence at the sentencing. The government was prevented from doing that because the judge said, I don't want to hear about that. So they made a proffer. He said, I don't want to hear about that. I think you should go charge him in Texas and Arizona and whatnot. And my question is just, isn't that an error of law? Not that the judge couldn't have found it wasn't relevant conduct because it wasn't part of the same scheme, but that the judge simply said, stuff that happens in other states, I don't want to hear about it.
Well, in the sense that he has to consider relevant conduct in order to come up with a guideline sentence, yes, it would be an error of law. But by the same token, he is allowed to reject that as a basis, and I think that's what he was saying that he was doing. Now, I did not read the record to say that the judge would not allow them to make a proffer. In fact, I read it to say that he would allow them to make a proffer, and they just didn't do it. What happened was the defendant objected to the use of all this hearsay in the warrant to calculate the amount of relevant conduct from these other offenses. And so
But they did make a proffer of the agent's timeline and whatnot, and he said it'd be part of the record and all of that, and wasn't interested in hearing further evidence on that because he didn't think that this was appropriate to consider.
Well, I don't think that they ever made they actually made the proffer into the record, but what I think he was saying is that he rejects that as a basis for enhancing his sentence, which he can under Gall and Kimbrough. He can find that that is not a proper basis, as I understand those two cases.
But not if he says that he's not supposed to consider those things. There's a difference between saying you're not allowed to consider something, and then saying, I don't find it to be persuasive. And his language was, I think it's fair to this defendant or any other defendant to add in effect for sentencing purposes conduct from other indictable offenses that in essence are separate crimes and could be charged in different places. He's not making a specific factual determination about the propriety of this sentence with regard to this defendant. He's saying it's not fair across the board for anybody to use this, and this is a factor that is specifically allowable under the guidelines. Does this not require remand for resentencing? And if not, please tell me why.
Well, because I think he's made it pretty clear that even if he considers it.
Where does he say that?
He doesn't say, assuming
arguendo, I am considering it, I still would do the same thing. That's always magic language in sentencing. But where is that here?
He doesn't say those exact words, but I think he's made it pretty clear in that case, and he says that he feels that way in other cases, that he's not going to do it. So if we remand it, he's going to do the same thing and just put the magic language in there.
But that's not a basis not to remand a case, that we think the judge is going to do the same thing. That happens all the time when we remand them.
It does, but the burden is on the government here to show that he would do something different.
No, it's not.
It's on you.
No.
Because you have to show that the error is harmless. If they prove an error, you have to show it's harmless. And to show it's harmless, you have to show it didn't make any difference.
Well, I think Judge Barber has made it pretty clear throughout the years, and by what he said here, that he has made it clear throughout the years that he's not going to sentence somebody based on what they have said in an indictment and in a search warrant affidavit about something else. And I think that he did not make a finding that he believed this evidence to be true. He just said there was substantial evidence in the record. He did not say that it was substantial, credible evidence.
But does anyone have any, if no one has any further questions, we've held you over. You have saved your time for rebuttal. Thank you very much, counsel. Good morning. Can you start with the sentencing issue? And
yes.
Do we have to remand or do we have any alternative?
The court has no alternative under the law but to remand. Judge Barber may well end up at the same place, but he has to go through the necessary steps.
And one if of the we steps- remand on your issue, can't we remand and say they can consider the defendant's sentencing issue too if we're going to have a resentencing? Why shouldn't the why would we have to resolve that issue?
Well, that's exactly right. In the course of considering the remand and taking into account the conduct from outside of the count of conviction, the court necessarily would have to be looking at the other cash that was found and whether that could be converted into marijuana, as was done with respect to the cash found at the house. So the answer is the court need not consider that issue because it's going to be considered in the course of this remand.
I'm still confused because here we have a judge who's a very seasoned judge, and not somebody brand new, not somebody confused or mistaken about the law or whatever, seeming to just failed to follow a very basic proposition, which is that relevant conduct is everything that's part of the same or similar transaction, whether it occurred in Jackson, Mississippi, or Phoenix, Arizona, or anywhere else, that the temporal boundaries are not the relevant question. So what am I missing here? Because I'm going to assume this judge knows the law well.
Let's take the judge at his own words in the sentencing. He said he thinks it's a question of fairness. He doesn't think it's fair to hold the defendant who's in court on a single count of conviction relating to a single instance of possession with an intent to distribute, that he should be held accountable for this entire course of conduct. Well, that, as you know, Your Honor, misreads what the Supreme Court has said, which is that the defendant, when the court takes into account other conduct, the court is not taking into account conduct for the purpose of punishing the defendant for conduct other than the conduct that's the result of the conviction. In the Watts case cited in our brief at page 55, the Supreme Court said, consideration of information about a defendant's conduct does not result in the punishment for any offense other than the one for which the defendant was convicted.
Yeah, I mean, you're trying to find where within a range to put a defendant. I get that. But in a way, if the judge has made up his mind that, look, whatever the law is, I don't care about this stuff in Phoenix, then are we just engaging in an empty effort by remanding? If the judge is just going to say, okay, the guidelines are now XYZ, I don't care. I still don't want to consider what happened in Phoenix, right, and I'm still going to give you, you know, this sentence.
Well, it's possible that the judge could approach this in several different ways. One would be to look at the evidence of the relevant conduct. He said in connection with this sentencing, he thought there was substantial evidence of the relevant conduct. He may have a different view when he really does apply it in the way that this Ms. Epps says and look at it for purposes of sentencing. He didn't make a factual finding per se, but he did say that there was substantial evidence. So that may be one way that it gets considered. And the other is the court nevertheless has to go through this step, according to the law, of taking into account relevant conduct. But that's only one factor in deciding a sentence. There are other factors under 3553A that the court needs to go consider as well. This court, this judge in this case, looked at the guidelines, incorrectly determined the guidelines, and ended his analysis. So this case, it does need to go back for the judge to...
How did the PSR treat the
PSR brought in all of the conduct.
Sorry.
The PSR brought in all of the conduct, Your Honor.
Do you have any comment on the fact that this is could be a somewhat empty dance where if he had just said it differently, this would all be fine, and he can just say it differently now, and are we wasting everyone's time and money? And
I understand that sort of that view, but we're here to follow the law. We're here to go take the process step by step. Judge Higginbotham authored a couple of the decisions referred to in our brief that go to the first step in applying the guidelines is to correctly determine the guidelines.
So you're saying this is a gall procedural error that they haven't proven is harmless error.
That is correct.
As a matter of law, and therefore we got to send it back, and we have to assume that the district judge will in fact pay attention to our opinion and follow the law, and not that he will disregard it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, I think we've covered this. Tell us why the search warrant wasn't stale.
Well, I think the best case is from the Freeman case cited in our brief. It's a doctrine. It's a case about the kind of interesting facts about a guy who ran a scuba operation, and they hid false bottoms of the scuba tanks. They hid drugs. So this guy basically ran the scuba business, and in the Freeman case is cited in our brief at page 18 of the main brief. And it talks about personal and business financial records, and specifically on the subject of staleness, says that bank records and other records of that sort are the sort of records that would normally be found at one's residence. So you have Mr. Bonds, who has this residence. He's seen there the morning of the search. There's an indication he's staying there. He may have other places he stays. He's got a business that he runs, Bonds Auto Sales. There's no auto lot. He's got another business called it's a trucking business. Both are registered to this business, this Biloxi street address in Jackson. You go there, you don't find either one of the businesses. There's no car lot. The only place where you find the car is there are four cars parked at his house. So you begin to think, well, this may be where you might find some of the records. And, of course, there, Ms. Epps says there were no records found at the house. Well, that's not true. There were bank records found. They were produced as Exhibit 26, trial, Government Exhibit 26. There were bank records of the couple. So those are the kind of records that you expect to find.
Do you win because bank records were requested, personal records were requested, but if it was just drugs, then you would lose?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that we have a much stronger case for financial records.
Because it's pretty stale for drugs.
I don't think that there was really ever any expectation that you would find necessarily if this is where the drugs would be. Ms. Epps keeps emphasizing, well, where are the drugs? Well, there's no indication that's necessarily where they were. Mm-hmm. They were at that time. They were
You're always going to put records in the affidavit when you.
Right, but this.
Well, sure you are, because for the same reasons that are here. That's not a criticism. It's just good practice. But the records you're going to normally find is really the evidence of the transaction. It's going to be the scales, the money.
That's right.
Things like that. They don't usually have a double entry bookkeeping system.
Thank you, Your Honors. If there are other questions, we're going to ask this court to affirm the conviction and remand for resentencing.
Well, I just want one other question. I'm a little puzzled by the Judge Barber is one of our really fine judges and very experienced. This thing just kind of drifted off. I'm not sure what happened on that sentencing calculation. What did the government say at the time? I assume you were on your feet and explained to the judge that's a mistake.
Darren Lamarcker, the prosecutor who tried the case and handled the sentencing, did was he clearly indicated in the lead up to the sentencing that the government had a different position than the defense.
What was your objection at the trial? I mean, you have a trial judge and he's making a mistake. U.S. attorneys have got to.
Darren Lamarcker made clear to the judge.
This judge is going to rely on you to correct some of those things.
He said that he wanted to make a proffer of what was in what the evidence would show at sentencing if the judge took into account the relevant conduct. So that is in essence the way that the government articulated its objection to the sentencing outcome. I should point out.
Was it an objection or what? I just want to be real clear that you did object, and then
I would suggest that what was done should be construed as an objection.
I know you'd want to be delicate about those kind of things, but you have
specifically what was the objection?
But you still got to object.
The government was in the process of arguing for the pre-sentence report inclusion of relevant conduct, and the judge said cut the prosecutor off, saying I'm not going to consider that conduct. Later on, the discussion is that the government is going to offer the proffer of what the proof would be. There's no purpose for offering a proffer of what the proof would be unless you're disagreeing with the judge and you're making a record for appeal.
You're trying to persuade the judge to go some way, but if you don't say when he's plainly going the other direction, Your Honor, we object to that, or communicate to him that you're at your position.
This was a narrow issue of relevant conduct.
Right.
And the only issue before the court was relevant conduct.
Right. Well, I mean, what happened was the PSR included it.
That's right.
The defendant objected.
That's correct.
The judge sustained the defendant's objection. The government then said, well, wait a minute, as I understand it, you're leaving this out. Well, then I want to make a proffer. And the judge said, okay, you've got your proffer, but I'm not going to consider it.
But you didn't use any magic words that we object to the procedural or substantive reasonableness, these kind of things that we usually have this on the other foot. And so then we end up in plain error land. If we end up in plain error land, we do not send back for resentencing, do we?
It's our position, Your Honor, that a fair reading of this of what went on at the sentencing was that the government was voicing its objection to the sentencing.
Right, but if there is not an objection, how do you win?
The government was allowed to make its proffer. I do want to point that out. It's in reply brief at page 5 at note 2.
I mean, the judge...
That doesn't answer the question. I'm sorry, just, I need to get an answer. How do you win if there is no objection? To say they made a proffer is just another way of saying they were making an objection. How do you win if there is not a properly preserved objection?
There needs to be something that can be construed as an objection. There's no question, Your Honor.
No, but assuming arguendo, there is no objection, do you lose your quest for the resentencing?
I think we'd have to show plain error.
That's what I'm asking you. Can you show plain error on this record?
We have an error. It's clear. We'd have to show meet the other factors. The court.
I know. I'm asking you to do that, sir. Can you do that, sir? Can you meet prong three and prong four in this case?
Well, prong four is ultimately the court's discretionary call.
I understand, sir.
We think that this is a gross...
I don't mean to get you off on this. I just want to know if you objected. I haven't read the actual record itself. Not, if you tell me you objected, then that's good enough. I'll read it and see. So it's not a problem for me.
I mean, the court is clearly understanding what the government's asking it to do and refusing to do it. I don't know that a magic word is necessary.
Well,
it says, in essence, what the government, as I understand, is trying to do is to get the court to accept as relevant conduct, the conduct for which there's some reference in the record of an ongoing importation scheme from Mexico to Arizona. The court understands that. However, this man was not charged with that conspiracy, and I'm not going to consider it. And then you had the whole proper discussion. But does it affect your substantial rights, the miscalculation of the guidelines, if we decide it's plain error?
Let me take it step by step. Government.
Does
records?
It change the guideline calculation?
Oh, yes.
And what have we said in the past about the effect of a different guideline calculation on substantial rights?
Right. Well, I think it would affect our substantial rights. Absolutely. And the discussion in this.
Did your opponent argue that it's a plain error review?
No, Your Honor.
And that it wasn't preserved?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
We'll argue when we get off the bat.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Epps, you have a rebuttal for us?
It's very brief, I hope.
Did you argue that this wasn't preserved?
No.
Do you think it was not preserved?
I think it probably was not. If the same standard applies to them that applies to me, then it wasn't preserved. I've lost too many times on plain error not to know.
Well, that's why Escalante Reyes has some significance for both sides, you know, because sometimes... The government's asking for plain error, but you did not make that argument or that contention.
No, I don't believe I did.
Okay.
But the court determines the standard, not the parties.
That's right. The court pretty much determines everything.
Well, thank you. That's a good summary for the audience here.
The court wins. I would just like to win one every now and then, if you don't mind. But the government says Freeman is its best case on the search. The problem and the difference, I think, between our case and Freeman is that in that case, it was logical to infer that the drugs might be at, or the business records might be at the house because he didn't have a place of business. That had not been dealt with. So we've got a difference here. And as for the bank records, the bank records, by the way, they did find bank records pertaining to both of them, but they didn't find any records pertaining to drug dealing. Now, that, of course, is beside the point, but I did just want to clarify that. But you have to have a timely nexus between the records and the house as well. There were obviously other places where he could have kept drug dealing records if he wanted to. The Lynch Street house, for one thing, the Lynch Street building, rather, his girlfriend's house. There just is, I think, not a timely enough nexus to get you into this house if you let... If the mere fact that somebody's seen the drugs years ago and he has an ongoing drug dealing thing that may or may not have been in play, sometime within the last few months, then you could get into anybody's house on this. So,
was the district judge talking about, was he expressing that there were separate schemes here? If he thought they were separate schemes, would they have been correct? I mean, if they really were, if he thought found there were separate schemes, would the sentence have been sound?
If he thought that there were separate schemes on the sentencing, well, he certainly could have believed that, I think. I think
his explanations were not real clear, abstractly, but if put them in context, he may have, I just wondered if he saw those as a very separate transaction. A drug dealer, he's got something going in Arizona some time ago, and he's got something going here. He may see those. Because he said that these were separately indictable offenses, and if you wanted to go after him, you would. That suggests to me that that's exactly what he's thinking, is that these are separate offenses.
I think he thought, he was charged in Texas.
I don't
remember
you arguing that, but nonetheless, as I read his language, I'm just searching for the fact. District judges don't usually make that kind of direct. They have something in their mind, and that would be a perfectly sound sentence. And what we're doing is we're putting to one side what his reasons were, his language suggested that he involved in two completely separate drug trafficking schemes. One was cocaine, one was marijuana, at different places. Would that explain it?
I think it could be explained as two separate schemes, but I think really what Judge Barber, I think there were two things that were bothering Judge Barber.
Sorry.
I think there were two things that were bothering Judge Barber. One was that the evidence of the amounts that the government was asking that the sentence be increased by were in the search warrant affidavit. The defendant objected to it as being hearsay and unreliable, and I think the judge was trying to express that, yes, he understood that that was in the warrant, but it hadn't been presented at the trial. And so, without that, he was concerned about adding those amounts, which could be added in the Texas case if they were going to do that. And I think that is what his concern that he's talking about here is, that where you're increasing somebody's sentence based on potentially unreliable information that the government did not add. Offer any actual proof on, other than this hearsay from informants, then it was just simply unreliable. And I think he did not express himself as artfully as he could have, because he did not understand what the government's objection.
Well, it could be separate transactions, and that be a basis for proper basis for sending a warrant, but it may not be. It may be perfectly all right to do what the district judge did here. That was my suggestion.
Well, there's not a lot of connection in those affidavits between Arizona and Texas, other than the fact that the drugs may have come from Mexico. But
okay. Well,
thank you. Consider that a connection.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. Recognize Ms. Epps as court appointed. Thank you for your service.